Chef John Fulce welcoming you to Stirring It Up, the best tasting show on radio. From the swamps and bayous of South Louisiana, thanks for joining us in our little piece of culinary heaven where good cooking is just a way of life. Mornings begin here with a roux simmering in a cast iron pot, and our evenings end with thoughts of what we're going to cook tomorrow. Everybody, it's another great day in the big studio kitchen today, and it's so nice to have all of you with us, and we want to thank you so much for choosing us against all of those other distractions that you have in your life and the world, and you've chosen to be around the kitchen table with us today. That is very nice, Michelle, that they would do that.
Absolutely, it is.
So how are you doing?
I'm doing very well. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good today.
Most importantly, you have my Christmas present yet?
Well, I don't have your Christmas present yet, but I'm looking. Then across the glass wall over here, we're looking right into the face of our very competent engineer who keeps us all so well balanced and choosing great music, Slama, I have to say, you know?
Thank you. Thank you. That is a compliment. Compliments abound today, huh?
It's me. It's the season. People don't get to see the softer side of me.
You know today, you're going to show us the softer side.
Today is the softer side, Michelle. And it's because I've been drinking.
Uh-oh.
I've been sampling wine. Why, we have a great guest with us today, and I've been sampling some of the great wines of one of our local vintners here, and I've been enjoying it. So I'm a little light on my feet, so to speak, today.
See.
Huh?
You've been doing a little research.
I've been doing research. That's exactly right. I'm into my third book. I mean, Bible. Anyway, talking about that, Slama, yesterday I was in New Orleans. I had to go fight that traffic.
Getting over to Bienville. Huh?
Well, I had to go to Bienville, the corner. I had to go to the Times Square of New Orleans, which is Bourbon and Bienville, that corner right there. And, Michelle, I had an interview set up, which I'm sure. Mm-hmm. Do you remember I had an interview set up yesterday?
Well, of course. Who do you think sets these up?
I can always tell when Michelle is mad at me. She sets up a lot of interviews. Huh? But anyway, the interview yesterday was fantastic. I had this writer. My God, was he great. We were talking about the foods of Réveillon, right? And all these different topics came up from what did you eat for Thanksgiving? What did you eat for Christmas? What did you eat for New Year's? What's your Mardi Gras foods, you know? And anyway, so we got to talking, and in the conversation, he brought up the fact that he knew that I kind of dabbled in making some of the liqueurs.
You know? Word is spreading.
Well, he said, you know, this season of the year demands imbibing. You know, even if it's just a little nip, as Papere used to say it. I think that's part of the hospitality of the South, is that you join someone rather than in a duel, you join him in a sip.
Mm-hmm. My great-grandfather was very hospitable.
Yeah, he was hospitable. He was a drunk, in other words.
He just believed that it was 5 o'clock somewhere.
I think I met him laying down a couple of times that night. He was a great guy, I remember that. I never heard him speak. Anyway, y'all, we got to talking about these drinks, and I did give him a little sip of some of the different liqueurs that we made. But he went on to talk about how exciting it is, you know, around this time of year when people do come to visit, and if they're local, chances are pretty good they dabble a little bit in making some of their own, whether it's a blackberry wine or whether it's a ratafia or whether it's some of the hot toddy combinations that they love to make. They're always interested in doing a bounce that they might have from a great-grandfather recipe or something like that. And it really made me begin to think also about this great history, this great tradition of making a lot of these homemade wines and liqueurs up and down the river, I should say, from New Orleans to Baton Rouge. This is a hotbed of folks who like to drag out the crock.
There's something kind of fun about saying, oh, well, you know, I mean, you can cook something, but when you've actually created a beverage, you've invested time.
No, absolutely. A lot of time and a lot of time consuming it. Anyway, y'all, we do have a rich heritage of delicious inventive cuisine, and so do we have a great heritage of inventive beverage concoctions as well. Last night I had a really nice Creole café noir that would be very welcomed right now. You know,
I bet it would. You know, many Louisianans start their day that way, though. You know, once you've had Louisiana coffee, you really don't want anything else a lot of times. I mean, all Louisianians, 9 out of 10 carry their coffee with them, and you even have carried the pot to make sure that you have your Louisiana coffee when you travel.
I carry my coffee pot with me as I travel. I even make sure that Dan Ling, when she makes a phone call to make a room reservation for me, do y'all have in-hotel room pots for coffee? What kind of coffee are you serving them? Because I'm very particular about my coffee, and that's why I bought my own little pot to carry with me.
I have other words that I use to describe that other than particular, but yes.
And of course, at some point in time, you know, even the great writers of the world, I remember Hornet Kane and his Bayous of Louisiana would talk about coffee. And I remember reading it and thinking to myself, oh my God, this is fantastic. He would say that coffee had to be black and dripped, strength incarnate, that it just stained the cups.
And it does. It does stain the cups. But, you know, strong coffee is only one of our unique beverages. I mean, we're a cocktail culture. We're a homemade wine culture.
No,
you said a ratifia culture. When you were imbibing, did you happen to have any of those little fancy punches that are traditions of the Creoles?
Well, most of the punches were derived from the liqueurs that they made. So the more liqueurs that they made, the more fancy that punches could be, and the more the welcome table, let's say, of the liqueurs that would be presented to guests coming into the Creole homes could be anywhere from citrus notes to astringent notes to very sweet and spicy. I mean, even peppers went in. So much of our beverage history and traditions come from the early settlers, and they were helped by the Native Americans, no doubt about that, who taught them how to use so many of the wild plants and trees to enhance, so to speak, their homemade concoctions. Depending on the seasons, native black cherries. Remember you and I went find that black cherry tree on your family property?
Mm-hmm.
Black cherries, blackberries, mayhaws, all of these things went in. But kumquats and loquats and wild persimmons and wild quince that grew in the swamp of Louisiana, all of these could be used in infuse liqueurs. My ratifia is a perfect example. You know, I infuse different types of brandy with a certain amount of fruit and berries and even apples. It doesn't matter. Citrus makes beautiful, beautiful ones. And then I infuse those flavors into different types of brandies or rums or gins or whatever for up to 7 months to make sure I get an intense flavor. Well, and oh my God, once you have a sip of it. Oh.
Well, what about Pepere's Cherry Bounce? Was that ratifia?
Bounce is all ratifias. I mean, there's a lot of names for them, but bounces certainly are ratifias. I mean, anytime you take a fruit of any kind, it doesn't have to be a fruit either. Actually, it could be a vegetable, but
a vegetable wine?
No, of course, absolutely. You could put vegetable flavor. I mean, radish was one of them. The radishes gave liqueurs a peppery finish and a beautiful pink glow to it because of the red radishes. It had that pepper note to it. Absolutely. And it would sweeten them, too. Sometimes the pepper radish or the sweet radish ratifias. But, yeah, Papa had a great recipe for cherry bounce. And, of course, most Cajuns would start their homestead by finding first a cherry tree.
That was kind of requisite.
Yeah, that was prerequisite. If you found a cherry tree, you built your home there, and you tried desperately to buy that land from the neighbor because you know you would need that fruit for the cherry bounce. He always made his recipe very interestingly. Pepere's orang used to get from Mr. Nora's store. It's called Tip Top Grocery. And Tip Top Grocery sold that pickled pig feet in these beautiful gallon and a half or 2 gallon glass jars that had a handle on the top of them, big wide mouth cover. I mean, these were perfect for ratifia and bounces. He'd get a gallon and a half of pig feet, and Mr. Nora would deliver it with his little truck. He'd deliver it to our house about noon. At 12:30, the pig feet were gone out of the gallon and a half. Those pig feet were nothing but bones, baby. So even the dogs would walk away from the bones of a pig foot when it came out of the false home. They just said, nothing there for us to eat. We would take those jars, wash the vinegar out. Prepare would fill it up to about 3 inches to the top of this gallon and a half jar with these little black astringent sour cherries that grew on the wild black cherry tree. And then he would put over that about, 6-8 big cupfuls of sugar. And that was it. Then he put a tight lid on the top and put it on the bottom of the cabinet, always dated it on the top. I'll never forget, he put a piece of tape there and he'd write on there the date. And a year later, he normally figured it this year for next year.
Mm-hmm.
So if he was going to do his black cherries that came out in the summertime, June about, he'd fill up those jars. And then next Christmas, not this Christmas, next Christmas, he'd be ready to go. He'd strain everything out in this rich, luscious ratifia, this mixture of infused liqueurs and fruit would be a bottle. And then that's all cherry bounce. And yeah, I'll have his recipe, absolutely.
What liquor did he put in?
Normally, he would put in brandy, but of course, any kind, he would start it off with a little cup of brandy or so, but you didn't need any. The sugar and the berries would just naturally ferment inside of that jar and create this beautiful, beautiful drink. The juices and the sugars would just come together. He'd add a little cup of that brandy in there to get it started, so to speak. You with me?
A little cup for the jar, a little cup for prepare.
There's one famous herb-infused spirit in particular. You and I sip that often.
Well,
from time to time.
Yes, but
well, we've been together 16 years in this studio.
We have.
We've had a little sip of it every year.
Anyway, absinthe, I think, is what you're talking about.
Oh, maybe you were absent
spirit.
From the tasting.
I must have been absent from the absinthe tasting. But, you know, absinthe's now banned. But it gained a lot of notoriety in New Orleans. It's known as the Green Fairy, flavored with anise and other herbs. It does sound like a Christmas drink or a holiday drink. It was actually created in Switzerland as a medicinal elixir, which I can definitely see. I'm not personally a fan, but that's just me. It was used by Antoine Péchaud, a wealthy plantation owner in New Orleans, to create the Sazerac. Now, again, the Sazerac's kind of a stiff drink, too.
So you don't like stiff liquors?
I don't. He also created his own bitters that he used in the drink. And, of course, Sazeracs are still very popular today, minus the absinthe, of course.
Right. We come from a culture here in Louisiana of the French, the Spanish, the Italian settlers here. They all love their wines, the Germans as well. But Louisiana soil and climate weren't always friendly to the grape, with the exception of one in particular, the Muscadine grape. And the Muscadine grape is called the grape of the South, as most people refer to it, because it thrives in this hot and humid climate, and it needs fewer chilling hours to make. And in late August and early September, vines are just absolutely covered with these clusters. And of course, there's a lot of varieties today with different flavors. They have this tough skin that's great in making jellies and sauces, preserves and syrups, but also the famous sweet muscadine wine of the South. And typically, muscadine wine is sweet because a vintner's add sugar, as I just mentioned, Pepere did with a little bit of brandy put in it, added sugar during the winemaking process, making it an excellent dessert wine as well. Anyway, y'all, we're talking about Louisiana vintners. We're talking about homemade wines. We're talking about the season that, it's just so required that you have a cupboard full of this alcoholic elixir, right? I mean, you have to have it. I mean, it makes the season go by fast with all the family coming to visit. And you want a lot of that.
Makes it tolerable.
You don't want to go anywhere, because we're going to be back in just a second, and we have a great guest who's going to lead us through his journey on making wines here in Louisiana.
A bottle of red, a bottle of white. It all depends upon your appetite. I'll meet you anytime. Italian restaurant.
Greetings. I'm Jake Hebert.
And I'm Adam Chouard. Join us every Friday at midnight for the Sound Club radio program.
Your home for left field pop gems from today to yesteryear.
Here on 88.7 FM KRVS.
Hi, I'm Pete Bergeron. If your day starts early, like mine does, let's spend it together with Cajun music from 5 to 7 a.m. here at Public Radio for Acadiana, KRVS, 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles.
From the University of Louisiana at Lafayette, this is KRVS, 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles, now broadcasting in HD radio technology.
The days of wine and roses, laugh and run away, like a child at play. The meadowland toward a closing door, a door marked nevermore.
All right, everybody, welcome back to Stirring It Up, the best tasting and cultural radio show on the market today, I think, Michelle?
I think so.
Yeah, we're 50-50. I mean, food, culture. Well, we're actually 33.
The
other 33 is dedicated to foolishness.
Mm-hmm. Uh-oh.
I think that's...
Anyway, y'all, thank you so much for joining us and choosing us today to be around the kitchen table with your cup of coffee joining us. And we thank you so much. And today we're talking about a great subject that we love so much in the swamplands of South Louisiana, and that's producing wines at home with some of your local flavors, but also at the same time paying homage to those people who have taken a great leap into producing and bottling wines that are fit for the marketplace. That's what we're talking about today, which is a big jump in South Louisiana that's not known climate-wise or anything else for producing your own great vineyards out there. But people have gotten into it, and other people have just really been very creative in doing it as well. And we have a great guest today who's going to tell us about that.
Well, we do. We have Donald Becknell in the studio with us. He's a friend of yours. You know, when he and I were chatting the other day about getting ready for the radio show, I did not realize that y'all were in high school together.
That's exactly right. We were.
So it is just so nice to have someone with the inside scoop. It's very nice to have Donald with us. Donald is a mechanical engineer, and around 2000, he decided that creating a winery would be a good retirement business. He's still not retired, so now he has two jobs, running a winery and being a mechanical engineer. But in 2003, he actually built the facility. In 2011, he produced his first 5,000 bottles of Pierre Clidemont Becknell. It's a delight to have the cellar master with us and the little vintner from Vachery, I like to call Donald.
I like that, the vintner from Vachery.
That's
right. I like that a lot.
Welcome, Donald. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Michelle. Good morning. Morning, John.
Hey, good morning. So great to have you with us. Now, Michelle did mention that you and I go way back because our families go way back.
Correct.
I mean, the Becknells, my God.
Oh, my gosh. Here we go. Y'all were on the boat together, right? Is that it?
No. The Falses went back to get them. we forgot the Becknells. We went get the Becknells.
We had waited for a long time for them to show up again.
Anyway, the Becknells, a very big name in Vachery, the Becknells. And in fact, it was a bunch of my good friends. They owned the movie theater. They remember the Vachery Theater?
Correct.
I was telling you that the other day, Michelle. I had a family in the restaurant who used to own the Vachery Theater. That was the Kenneth Becknell family. He was in school with me as well. Did you know Kenneth Becknell?
Sure did.
Kenneth was a great guy.
And Daddy died in 1980, and Mama remarried another Becknell.
Yeah.
And it's Arthur Becknell, who lived right there at the corner.
Can you imagine a Becknell marrying a Becknell? Huh? That goes to show you how close the communities are back there at these names. No, sure. I mean,
that's
absolutely.
Right.
We do go way back. And my brother Jerry called me one day. Remember, we came to visit. Jerry called
me. Yeah, he slipped out of the office one day. We didn't know where he was. He got to take a tour. I haven't toured yet, but we'll go there another day.
Well, Donald, just to bring everybody up to date, because we do have wineries in Louisiana. Some of them are doing Muscadine wines. Others, like Pontchartrain Vineyards, are doing their things. There's all kind of craft beer companies now coming up in Louisiana. And what an interesting story that somebody, a mechanical engineer, would one day say, I'm very interested in something that is so totally different from anything happening in South Louisiana. Give us that voyage. What brought you to the point where you said, you know, I need to put something in a bottle?
Well, it started a very long time ago. Grew up on, you know, at Bessie Cay, which was just downriver from where you grew up. And Daddy went back to school, became an engineer, got a job at Shell and Norco. So we moved to Destrehan. So we lived in Destrehan for about 8 years. We came back 1962. I started sixth grade with Miss Ilya at St. James.
Oh, Miss Ilya. Oh.
And one of the first things that happened, because, you know, it was back on the plantation again, an old guy from the plantation said, Donald, would you like to learn how to make wine? Well, I was 11, and I said, yeah, I'm not doing anything else. I just soon give it a shot. And I tried. I tried to make wine, but it was voodoo back then. You know, they would talk about floating an egg in the water.
Right, sure.
Yeah, it was nothing that was consistent, so everything turned into vinegar. It didn't work. So at the grand old age of 14, I gave up.
This isn't for me, huh?
No. You know, I'd rather eat the berries than keep on destroying the berries. I didn't do much with it again until I got in graduate school. Our first child was born a couple of months before graduate school started. Our second child was born about 11 months into graduate school. And if you newly married and you have two children and you're in graduate school, you cannot drink alcohol unless you can make alcohol.
That was your inspiration.
It was a massive inspiration.
And I bet you needed a drink by that point.
No, because I actually enjoy making the wine more than drinking the wine. Making the wine is really, really fun. And I didn't know that much about wine. Pepere always had wine around because he worked for Mr. Henry and he was on the road a lot. So at special occasions, we would have wine. But it was beer and it was mixed drinks growing up, you know? And so I knew enough about wine that I needed some sugar and I knew I needed some fruit because of what they had taught me at Bessie Cay. But I was trying to make the wine as real as possible, so I said, well, it needs acid. I know wine has acid, so I used 2 vitamin C tablets. I used a bag of tea because I knew it needed tannins in it. And I took a 5-pound bag of white sugar and a 4-pound bag of raisins because raisins are in season all the time.
Right, that's right.
And I put all that in a Kentwood jug like on a Sunday afternoon the first time I tried it. And by Friday, it was not wine, but it was good enough to drink on a Friday in graduate school. So the whole time I was in graduate school, I never drank any wine that was clear. Because I would finish it before it was done. And then over the years, as my kids got old, I would just keep on making the wine. And people would have leftover fruit, or a store would have leftover fruit. So I would try different things. But it was relatively inconsistent. Plus, we got to the point where my youngest son, it was like Hawaii raising out of the ocean. Because in the Kentwood jug, I would siphon some down every Friday afternoon that I would use over the weekend. And Lego toys started appearing. And film canisters. And toothbrushes and silverware and string and bobbins of thread. And you finally get to the point, no matter how much you want to drink some wine, you put it off on the side for a while. So I quit for a few years until he quit doing that. And I started putting the jugs up higher. And Karen said, why don't we think about doing a winery as a retirement business? I said, it sounds good. I'm going to start it now so that it'll be established by the time it happened. She says, but you have to write everything down, because I made wine up until that point like we cook in Louisiana. Right, right. Whatever you have in the refrigerator, whatever's coming out of the garden, whatever came out of the water is what you make the gumbo, the soup with. So I started writing things down, and the wine started getting more and more inconsistent. And even if something didn't turn out quite right, I could go back and I could backtrack to exactly what I did. So I finally got to the point where it was pretty consistent. So we did the building in 2003, got the licensing in 2005, and finally I'm working with Republic. I don't know if y'all know Mike Bonfanti.
Sure.
He's been in the wine industry for approaching 40 years. And he's been involved in all phases of it. So I called up Greg Lucci at Republic, and he said, well, work with Mike Bonfanti, and he'll give you some guidance, and we'll see if we can get this going for you. I spent a couple of years trying out different batches and trying out different labels and things, and they finally sat me down and said, okay, we're getting real, real close. This is what you need to do. And Michelle was asking about, you know, how do we get this point with the packaging and everything. It was mainly driven by Mike Bonfanti. You know, he says, the shiny labels have to go. The bright colors have to go. These big pictures have to go. You need a tie into the culture. You need a tie into the plantation. Right, you need a tie into French. And he said, is there somebody in the family who has a name that you can use? Well, Pierre Clidemont Becknell was the person that in 1832 converted what's now Evergreen Plantation. But Evergreen Plantation was originally built around 1795 mm-hmm. as an Acadian cottage. That was the first residence that was on Evergreen today. And in 1832, Pierre Clidemont Becknell renovated it for his aunt, who was a Sangie, and turned it into the plantation house. So kept everything French. You know, he said, do the labels like this, do the bottle like this. So it was a collaboration between the distributor and me when I got to this point. And then when we finally got the wine bottled in the spring of 2011, because Mike Bonfanti the whole time is telling me, do about this many bottles of wine, because that way it's going to last 6 to 18 months. We'll see how it's going to go, and we'll know whether or not which direction you want to go in, and it'll give you some time to respond. Well, Rouse's liked the wine, and Republic was really, really good with promoting the wine, and the wine went. The 5,000 bottles of wine went in 6 weeks. They said that's a good thing, but it's a miserable feeling. You know, I would have been so happy if it would have lasted 6 to 18 months, and then I could have started doing other things and gone, but it's been free-fall catch-up ever since. This year, I'm going to be doing about 10,000 bottles of wine. I'm about halfway through that right now, and I'm getting ready to bottle my first batch of, well, I've got the blackberry, the red raspberry, and the black currant, and I'm getting ready to do my first commercial batch of sugarcane wine. So I'm going to have a sugarcane wine, which is a slightly sweeter wine. The rest of the wines are dry. But I'm going to do about 10,000 bottles this year, and I'm shooting for at least 20,000 bottles next year. I'm going to add on some additional space at the building because I just need more room for tanks and things. So it's gone really, 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 really well.
You really are getting a great response out there. You can always tell when success is on the horizon because, I mean, I first found out about the wines through newspaper articles that people were writing about you. And I mean, you were right down the road, but correct. I didn't know it was going on.
Correct.
Then radio shows or whatever. So things started. So then a wine salesman would stop and say, oh, by the way, y'all have this wine. So we already knew that there was something happening that was good because people were talking about it. They weren't saying, oh, you know, it's horrible wine going on down there. They were talking about the good things about the work you were doing, which was really great. You know?
You know, you mentioned a second ago about it's a dry fruit wine.
Correct.
So, first of all, kind of tell us what you mean by that, because there are a lot of fruit wines. Louisiana, I think, is probably traditionally or in the last decade or two, known for fruit wines. I mean, that's what Amato produces or has. And
like the strawberry wines.
Right, the strawberry wines. So you have a berry wine, but it's a dry berry wine. So this is different. This is a different product that you're producing.
Traditionally, wines that are served with food that are paired with a meal are fermented so that most of the sugar is gone. There might be some sugar, but there's not a whole lot of it left in it. Whereas traditionally and historically, fruit wines have been done to a point where it's still a sweet wine. It's more of a socialize and enjoying sitting around a hunting club or sitting on somebody's back porch or putting ice in it. It's more of a sipping sweet wine. It really clashes with food because of the sugar. And Republic felt that there was just enough of traditional wines, and they steered me away from doing, you know, Merlots or Chardonnays or, you know, other wines. And they did not want to really approach any more sweet fruit wines because they said, you're going to be bucking the market that's already there. So if you try doing the dry fruit wines, we'll throw Republic behind you. We'll throw 100% behind you. And after we met two or three times, I said, okay, now tell me about the market for dry fruit wines. And they said, well, Don, you're going to either do really, really well or you're going to fail because there is no market for dry fruit wines. If you can establish it, it will be yours.
It went well then.
Yeah, but the whole challenge was, as they said, it may not go at all, but it has gone very, very well. Rouse's has been phenomenal. Republic has been phenomenal. And there are some restaurants that are serving it too, which is really, really great. As restaurants, I never would have approached because to me, it's more of a, you know, a home type of wine. But there have been some significant restaurants that want it. Dickie Brennan Steakhouse serves it. Nola does. Emeralds does. Commander's Palace tasted the sugarcane wine, and Dan Davis is interested in the sugarcane wine, which like floors me because Republic is so good at what they do, and they know the customers taste so well that they know what to approach, you know, with which wine, and it's gone really well. It's been really well accepted.
Now you notice we talked earlier about the families of the River Road. You know, you have these German families, you have the Acadian French families, you have the Old World French families as well, and then you have this melange of Spanish and Italian and African and all these other cultures up and down the river, and all of them dabble into some of these early fruit wines, as
correct,
we talk about, and then of course you've elevated here. What about your family? You remember any stories of your grandfathers or uncles or anybody who did any type of winemaking, or was that something that just didn't take place in your side?
My great-grandfather, which lived in Rabbit Town, not too far from the ferry, my mom's dad's dad did make wine, and they would keep the demijohns underneath the house. They had the cane syrup and demijohn, they had the wine and demijohn. But directly in my grandpa's generation on down, there was really nobody who was making wine. I've learned since having a winery that there are many people in the Vacherie area who do make wine. A man who was next door where you are, Mr. Herman Lede's blackberry wine, is phenomenally good.
Right,
blackberry
right.
Wine. So there are a lot of people in Vacherie who do it. There are people across the river, the Gravois family, Ozan Gravois family, and they make barrels of cherry bounce every year, and they use it most at tailgating, you know, that was
right.
Things like that. So there are people who do it. It's not like hunting clubs. It's like individuals who happen to do it, and you just might run across somebody because, you know, somebody gives a bottle to somebody who passes it on. But a lot of people in Vacherie, but not a whole lot in my family.
Also, what makes you unique is that wineries all over the world, California, I mean, Oregon wineries, they don't all grow their own grapes. I mean, a lot of them hire farms to grow grapes, and they buy those grapes. Are they estate grown where they're all growing their own? It depends what you're looking for. Now, you, on the other hand, have taken it one step further. You say, well, I don't need to grow grapes. There's people who do that, and there's also people who crush grapes. So tell us about your raw material.
The raw materials are coming in as frozen juice concentrates. They're coming in from Oregon. The red raspberries and the blackberries come in from Oregon. They're grown in Oregon. 85% of the cane berries in the United States are grown in that area. And just like we have automated ways to harvest sugarcane and process sugarcane, they have automated ways to pick it. It's the labor that would really, really get me. And the black currant comes in from Canada, and it comes in from Europe. There's a couple other fruits that I'm thinking about using, probably going to be coming in from California. But the reason I went in that direction, John, was because, remember, I wanted a small retirement winery that when I wanted to see people that day, I'd put a sign up on River Road. And if I didn't want to be involved with it, I would just take the sign down. So it was going to be something that I could control. I wasn't looking to sell a whole lot of wine. So I did it because I didn't want to be dependent on what I could do and get all wrapped up in that. But it's worked out really, really well because the things that you can get as far as the juices that I have coming in are pretty consistent, and I've got a good variety, and I can make twice as much blackberry this year if I needed all.
Right. So you're getting the concentrated frozen juice, and it comes in, and then you just defrost it. and then you use that as the base as a winery may just begin by putting grapes into a...
Correct. And that way I can start wine whenever I want to, whereas if I was raising the crops, I would have to do everything and be labor intensive when the crops are coming in. This way I can spread it out over the year. Also, I'm using the raw sugar that comes from the sugar cane that's raised on my land. Mike Wagasback raises the sugar and it goes to the mill. And I'm using my own sugar from the plantation. It goes into the wine.
We were talking about the aging process, because you do age it, but for how long? In oak barrels? Or, I mean, how do you, what do you do?
There's no oak barrels in Vashri. When I did the winery, I did not want to get into the expense of the stainless steel tanks or the oak barrels, because very, very expensive, very heavy. The oak barrels have maintenance on them. You've got to replace the staves that rot on it. The stainless steel tanks, you have to have equipment to handle it. And you know where it goes, it's pretty much in place. And I happened to come across, because I was trying to consider different things, a lot of wineries will store finished wine in plastic. And then I said, well, let me go see what I'm going to suffer on the stainless steel tanks or the oak barrels. And I found out that the totes that I was considering using breathe oxygen at the same rate as two-year-old wine barrels. Wow. So it's like hog heaven. So what I pay for a tote is so much less than what I'm paying for the wooden barrels or for the stainless steel tanks that it's really, really kept the cost down.
And the maintenance too. I mean, that's
tremendously. Yeah.
How long did your wine age?
Year to year and a half.
Okay.
From the time it starts to the time it's done. Typically, fruit wines are not aged. Typically, fruit wines are made and then they're just done. But fruit wines actually do benefit from some aging, even though that was even a surprise to Republic, because everybody in the industry just thought you make fruit wines and you sell them, but it helps them. It smooths them out a lot.
So what about length of aging? Does it get better with more aging?
What happens in a classical wine, like a grape wine, it gets to the point where it's kind of like optimal. What happens in fruit wine is it's different. Like in 6 months, it's different, but it's still good, but it's different. It doesn't like progress to just weakness. You know how regular wine's
right,
doing
right,
the
right,
color
sure,
and everything
sure.
drops out? Fruit wine stays different from 6 months to 6 months a year. So the aging, I've done a lot, and it does help.
Well, y'all, we're talking about wines, and we're talking to someone who knows a lot about it and someone who was able to take a chance, walk out onto that limb and grab hold and say, you know what, I'm going to take a little risk here and open a winery in Vashri, Louisiana, where there's no grapes, there's no oak barrels. And he's setting the world on fire. We're going to be back here in just a minute, and we're going to continue to talk with somebody that's a great asset to the state, Donald Becknell. We'll see you in a minute.
Building a music library on your shelf or on your hard disk. If you want to make sure it has a Celtic core, join me for some suggestions on the Thistle and Shamrock.
Coming up Sunday evening at 6 here on KRVS.
Avec Val. Bienvenue dans le monde francophone. C'est tous les jeudis à 9h sur KRVS, la radio Acadie.
Hi everyone, this is Pat Mitchell-Worley, and coming up on Beale Street Caravan, we've got Larry McRae at the 2012 Memphis in May Beale Street Music Fest. We'll also go to the 2011 King Biscuit Blues Festival and hear from Hamilton Loomis. That plus a new feature host segment from Dave Marsh. It's called Heavenly Sight, A Vision Out of Blindness. That's all coming up next time on Beale Street Caravan.
Tonight at 11 on KRVS.
T'as des misères à réveiller les dimanches matins? Mais allume la radio avec moi, Louis Michaud, tous les dimanches matins, 7h jusqu'à 9h. On va charrer en français, coup de la musique en français, and boire une petite tasse de café. Join me, Louis Michaud, if you have trouble waking up in the Sunday mornings. Just turn your radio to KRVS from 7 to 9 and hear me with Le Réveil, the awakening en français.
Warm red wine, you know that place where you take me sometimes, where my cares have wings and fly right off my shoulder, where I leave my cares behind and for a while.
All right, welcome back, everybody, to Starring It Up, the best-tasting show on radio. And we're so happy to have you with us today. And, of course, we're talking to Donald Becknell here in the studio about his great little wine company in Vacherie, Louisiana, right? And, Michelle, I know you also want to remind everybody about our little Stirring It Up page.
That's exactly right. Facebook.com/Stirring It Up Radio. Inviting everybody to drop us a line and... You kind of instituted a little contest of sorts.
A week or so ago, Islam, remember, we are encouraging our stovehounds out there, our radio listeners, to take a photograph of their favorite dish.
And the prize is
you get to come and be our guest to talk about family traditions and why you love to cook. And
so we're going to start with a real delicious, tantalizing photo.
Tantalizing photo, holding the dish, telling us your story, like one or two lines. So you make a note, okay? Michelle, I think this thing's getting legs.
I think it's getting something.
All right, Stovehounds, you know what we have to do? Starring It Up Radio. And if I look, and all you have to do, David Hubble can tell you, because he's been here, he's the president of the Stovehound Club.
Yes.
He can tell you the great time he had driving from Alabama to come and cook here for 30 minutes.
And I was absent that day. I was fishing. He's got to come back.
But anyway, we're serious about this, everybody.
Stirring It Up Radio.
Yeah, and that's kind of called the key to the door. That's called the key to the door. You come in that door right there, and eventually the screen door will open to the big studio kitchen. You'll be sitting right here with, you'll see Michelle in person. Because everybody always wants to know what you look like. And, of course, I tell them stories.
You tell them stories.
Do I tell them stories? You better believe it. That's why I change your picture on the webpage every week so that people say,
keep
oh, my
guessing.
God,
you're
playing your picture. Anyway, y'all, hey, look, Donald's sitting here with all of this great knowledge, and we're wasting his time. But I have a bottle of his beautiful Pierre Clément Becknell black currant wine in my hand right here. Mm-hmm. And, Michelle, had you not seen this, big red bowl for Christmas. Not if you've seen it. Now I got to start thinking again.
Donald brought my own bottle.
Oh, he did.
He brought me my own bottle, so you can't re-gift that. Don't get any ideas.
Donald, new wines, new vendor. What are you thinking about for the future now that, I mean, you've gained success? You're on your 10,000 bottle year this year, and, I mean, everybody seems to be excited about it. I know Republic is one of the great distributors out there.
They are
Through all the different states. They're a big supporter of yours, and I know you're getting a good role in publicity here. So what's the future looking like?
I'm going to try some additional fruit. The next two that I want to try is going to be peach and pomegranate because it's common here, and peach because I would like to have a lighter wine. The wine's a little heavier. Karen, my wife, came up with mint julep syrup, and it's all natural, all organic, and we've done some sample batches, and we brought them to Republic. Republic likes it a lot. I'm going to be bringing in some wines from France. I've formed an association with a cooperative of 30 wineries, a multi-generational family wineries in France. Small wineries. The wine that they make is just from the grapes from their vineyard there, and it's the family that keeps it up. We're in the final stages with getting ready to order some. We're going to start with restaurants and chefs with the Republic, and then we're going to bring some additional samples because they also have some biodynamic and some organic wines.
Right.
So I'm going to try to do something with Whole Foods, but the next phase is going to be Rouse's, definitely, because Rouse has been so great to deal with. And there's some additional chains that Republic wants to go to. The other thing I want to do is, and I've started on the application, because each process is a different application with the government, I've started on the application to operate as a distillery because I would like to do some liqueurs. I'm really intrigued by things like cherry bounce, because growing up I thought cherry bounce was just a local drink, and it's not. It's something that was since the original 13 colonies.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And it covers a large area, but there's no one who produces commercial cherry bounce. I like the fact that I have dry fruit wines, and there's very few dry fruit wines. I kind of like that position a lot.
Even though
it's sink or swim, you know?
Well, you're swimming.
Yeah, swimming. Yeah. In fact, I'm being pulled by a tugboat right now. It was like being thrown onto a speeding train blindfolded. I would like to do some things that are very tied into the culture here, like the cherry bounce and the mint juleps and stuff like that. So,
as you know, I've been dabbling in it myself, which is why you interest me so much as well. And Michelle and I were in London for the Olympics in July and August. And we traveled a little bit around the countryside, and we were lucky to go into this little village outside of Oxford and find the origin of one of the great drinks that so many people know, the slow gin.
Right.
And this beautiful little decanter that only had like two little one-ounce portions in it, beautiful little crystal decanter sitting on the nightstand with this luscious red color in it, and a slow gin with the story of this historic drink from Milton Mowbray, England. And tasting it, it was like nectar from the gods. Right. You know, it was just absolutely delicious. And I just couldn't get my mind off of it. So I came over here, and it didn't take me long before all the research, finding the recipe, the origin, and I created my first batch. And I'm sure, like you, I've come through enough of this infused flavored liqueurs to know now what I'm looking for. Right. And I knew immediately there was something missing in the original recipe, only to find out what it was, that they had actually infused it using almonds that gave it that little nutty thing that you mentioned, and so correctly, that nuts are really important in these kind of liqueurs. So I'm very interested and excited about it, as most people who grew up in this area who do experiment with some of these things. I just know there's a market for that stuff.
I agree.
The syrups that were so famous in early New Orleans, that you mentioned mint julep syrup a minute ago, the syrups were so important in cocktail. And I think with all the cocktails and the prohibition cocktails and this big cocktail movement in America, there's a need for these flavors. Flavored liqueurs, and I think there's also a great need for the specialty one. So,
yes.
So these are some of the kind of things that I'm very interested in chatting with you about. Do you actually ever get to chat or talk or visit with other winemakers in Louisiana to see what they're doing?
Periodically, we get together. John Siegel at Pontchartrain Vineyards is doing more what I would call a traditional wine. Jeff Landry, who moved from down here after Katrina up to West Monroe, is doing some Muscadine. He's doing some. He's got a Blackberry Merlot that's been pretty popular. It's probably the one that sells the most for Republic. And he's getting into aging. He's put in an aging cellar. Henry Amata is doing all of the fruit wines there. There's a winery in the Lake Charles area, Iowa, Lake Charles area, that's doing more of a cooking wine, an Italian cooking wine. Stephen Sheets has the winery out in Sanibel. He's probably the only one I have not talked to yet.
Right, right.
So I think what's going to happen in Louisiana, because it's so tough to raise the grapes, is that I think there's going to be a tendency to do more of a specialty wine until, like I was telling Michelle earlier this week, the Pierce disease has migrated over to California, so there's a lot of money being spent on it. Once that's solved, then we can grow wine making grapes here. Also ran into a Dr. John Posey, who was just retired neurosurgeon from Tulane, and he has actually modified. He's, I don't know if it's genetically or hybridly, but he's modified some grapes, and he's in propagation now. He made a batch last year that I brought to Republic, and they had a couple of suggestions about how the wine's made, but he's thinking about producing lots of it, but it's a real winemaking grape. And also, Henry Amata found a bunch grape, a winemaking bunch grape, just a heritage grape that was on his property that LSU is propagating now to. So I believe, because the French really tried when they first came to Louisiana, they tried to grow the vines, but the vines would die. That's why they would import in the old sheds, and they would rebottle it. I believe there's going to be a winemaking industry in Louisiana, because we're so tied into taste. Our culture is so taste and food oriented. You know, the reason why it's exciting what you do and me to do what I do is because it was part of life. You know, your grandma cooked or your mom cooked, or just there was always flavors and taste and smells around. I think the only thing that kills us is that it's hard for the grapes to grow here, but once that's solved, I believe it's going
to grow. You're absolutely right, and we're very proud to have you with us today on a great subject.
Thank you.
And Michelle, let's jump very quickly into books on the subject, because Slama, as you know, every week we try to make sure that we introduce our listeners to our resources. A lot of people think that we're just geniuses, and we're not. I mean, Michelle, we do have to have resources, so we go out and we try to share with you the resources that you can build your library. And if you get one book a week based on what we tell you our show's about, just think of your library. You'll have 52 books in a year.
That's exactly right.
So what are you encouraging people to do today based on our research.
Well, and this is one they're going to have to search for because it was published in 1961, but it was a little gem that I found on your culinary library bookshelf.
That's one of my historic books, right?
It's one of your historic books, and I would say that I bet it's one you've kind of forgotten about, but I know what you're going to say. No, no, I knew it was there.
Slama, I'll just be quiet at this point. Go ahead.
This book is part of your Warren LaRuth collection. These were books bequeathed to you from Warren LaRuth upon his death.
The fabulous chef of New Orleans, who I just admire and credit so much to inspiring me to cook.
And he was a mad scientist chef, so to speak. He was a research
chef. Absolutely.
So he created a lot of phenomenal brands that are on shelves today. There's an inscription in here in the cover page of the book, regards to Chef LaRuth from Major Lawmauer.
William Lawmauer, right? U.S. Air Force.
Right? That's right. And he says, I hope you enjoy reading about wines as much as I enjoyed writing it. So I thought that that was really interesting. It was a book given to Chef Warren LaRuth from the author. And it's just little snippets in here. It's delightful. It's honest. It's authoritative. It's kind of a memoir of wine. Things that he picked up through the years. There's a lot of history in it, a lot of musings about wine. It's fun. It's an easy read. I think a lot of times folks don't want to pick up something heavy at the end of the day to have to think a lot about. This, he's broken it up into paragraph by paragraph. There are three paragraphs on a page. You read a couple of them. You're enlightened. You've got something new.
And, why don't you read one paragraph for us? Just pick one at random.
Let's see. In that delightful game of mixing wines to suit yourself, do not overlook honey. The ancients used it in many wines, and they were on the right track when they did. Just try putting a few drops of honey in a glass of wine, which is too coarse. And don't forget that there are many kinds of honey, from very mild to very strong.
Now, this is a guy, the General William Lawmauer, actually traveled around the world as a major in the United States Air Force and got the love of wine. So as he went to every one of these countries and every one of these little hamlets and villages, he made notes about wine that he drank, searched out growers, searched out folks who were making wine, and kept his diary. And it's just good thoughts about wine. It's not about making wine or anything else. It's just things that you should know, as he just mentioned with the honey, and a coarse wine, meaning one that's undrinkable, right?
This is another kind of interesting one that I've just turned to. Among the odd names given to wine is Tears of Christ. How or why the name came to be applied to wine is not clear. It seems to have been applied first to white wines produced around Mount Vesuvius near Naples, Italy. Today, it means nothing, if it ever did, except that very ordinary wine is called by a very extraordinary name.
That's cool. What I love about that book. And that book you mentioned, Michelle, it brings back memories because you mentioned...
Oh, I didn't tell you the name of it, about wines.
Very simple. Warren LaRuth had LaRuth's restaurant in New Orleans, in Gretna, in fact, on the West Bank, and got his start at Solari's, the great Italian emporium. But he was absolutely a great gift giver, the first great chef, in my opinion, of modern-day New Orleans cookery. And his restaurant, LaRuth's, was the first to be recognized with the mobile stars and all in New Orleans, first mobile three-star restaurant in New Orleans. And he befriended me for whatever reason, I don't know, but he did. And I was the one who lucked up in the relationship. And then when he passed away, not only was I asked to eulogize him at his funeral, which was just amazing because the church was overflowing with well wishes from around the world, and I was able to go to the lectern and eulogize this great, great chefs, and there were chefs from all over the world in the room. And on the opening of Lafitte's Landing at Bittersweet Plantation, he came on opening night with a package all bowed up, and when I unwrapped it, it was a skillet. In the skillet was a card, and it was a gift from Warren LaRuth saying, this skillet traveled with me throughout the Korean War.
Wow.
As I traveled with the general who was in charge of quartermasters and ran the entire food division of the U.S. military. And he says, I cooked his breakfast in this skillet for 5 years. Wow. And now I'm giving it to you to keep. And that was one of Warren's gifts. I'm going to give all you hunters out there a gift. This is a rare, rare ringneck duck breast with red wine mushroom sauce. Mm-hmm. Rare meaning the texture and the doneness of the meat.
Mm-hmm.
You take 12 boneless breasts of either teal duck, wood duck, ring neck duck, it doesn't matter. You put it in a bag and you put 3/4 cup of dry red wine, a cup of sliced mushrooms, zest of one orange, 6 cloves of garlic crushed, two sprigs of thyme, and a little salt and pepper. And you let it sit for 24 hours in the refrigerator and let it pick up all of those wonderful flavors. Then you throw the breast into a hot skillet and you saute. Now remember, teal duck and wood duck, very small breast. So 2 minutes, they'll be medium rare. And you just turn them in a little olive oil to brown them lightly. And then you keep them warm as you take all of that wonderful flavor in the bag and you put it in the skillet, and to that you add a little shallots, a little orange juice, about a quarter cup, and then 1.5 cups of beef broth, and then you cook that down until it's syrupy in the skillet. That's all the marinade plus these wonderful little flavors of orange juice and beef broth. And you can even thicken it a little bit with cornstarch if you want to, but it makes a nice little syrupy finish. And you pour that over the warm duck breast, the medium rare. Most people like them rare because they're so fully flavored. And then you just serve them as a beautiful hors d'oeuvre with a little pick. And it requires red wine, and I can think of none better than this black currant wine that I'm looking at right here to make this dish with. And that's exactly what I'm going to do at my next hunting camp with a couple cups of this. Y'all, remember, drink responsibly. That's the main thing. Donald, thank you so much for being here with us and sharing all your great thoughts. We appreciate you being here. Look forward to chatting with you a little bit more about some of these great liqueurs and syrups, okay? Michelle?
See you next time.
Yep, y'all. We're going to see you next week.